data is becoming the 21st century engine of economic growth, like oil was in the 20th century and coal was in the 19th century and before.
Are you interested in the future of cities as the future of humanity? What do you think about space exploration as the next evolutionary step? How can we think about the smart city as an outcome? Stay tuned for answers from Jonathan Reichenthal.
What is the future for cities? Do you want to learn more about them? Do you want to know how others think about them? Do you want to be part of the conversation? Then this is the right place.
Welcome to What is the Future for Cities podcast. Today, I will interview Dr. Jonathan Reichenthal, CEO of Human Future, professor and advisor. We will talk about his vision for the future of cities, smart city, uncontrollable progress, autonomous vehicles, kids' books, and many more. So let's start with a proper introduction. Dr. Jonathan Reichenthal is a multiple award-winning technology and business leader whose career has spanned both the private and public sectors. He's been a senior software engineering manager, a director of technology innovation, and has served as chief innovation officer at both O'Reilly Media and the city of Palo Alto, California. Jonathan is currently the founder of advisory, investment, and education firm Human Future, and also creates online education for LinkedIn Learning. He has written 3 books on the future of cities: Smart Cities for Dummies, Exploring Smart Cities Activity Book for Kids, and Exploring Cities Bedtime Rhymes. His latest books include Data Governance for Dummies and the Cryptocurrency Quick Start Guide. And with that, Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for your time. I highly appreciate your appearance on the podcast. Let's jump right in. What does the future of the city mean to you?
Thanks, Fanny, for inviting me to be part of your important podcast about the future of cities. It's a topic I really enjoy to talk about. So I think I'm in the right place at the right time with the right person. Look, we know that over half the world already lives in cities. And if we look out through the 21st century, more and more people are moving into cities. I call it the century of cities. You know, if everything was perfect, we wouldn't have anything to talk about. That we would say cities are wonderful. But the truth is, cities have lots of issues, right? We have problems of economic issues. We have problems with healthy water and clean air. We have transportation issues. We want to transition from carbon energy to non-carbon, clean, abundant energy. So there's lots and lots of challenges. Those are just a few. So when I think about the future of cities, what I think about is how can we make cities great places to live and where the most amount of people can have a high quality of life? Like, we want everybody to thrive. I think if the city is successful, everybody has an opportunity, life is good, and people have purpose and happiness in the environment which they exist, where they spend all their time. So for me, that's what the future of cities is all about, is really the future of humanity, the future of the planet, and really our human experience, certainly through the 21st century and likely right through the 22nd century.
You said that the future of the city is equivalent to the future of humanity and the future of the planet.
Yes.
Will people stay on Earth?
I love that. I love that you went there so quickly. That's a question of time, I think. If you ask me in the 21st century, I think, yeah, I think we're pretty much hanging out here. We'll have an opportunity. Certainly, we'll go to the moon. We'll build a base there. In all likelihood, we'll get to Mars in the 21st century, and we'll probably build a permanent base there. Those seem like probable things. And there's a lot of science to be had, both to discover, but also we need science to make a sustainable human presence that's outside of the Earth. There's still a lot of challenges. The moon is a little bit more accessible. But once you get out to Mars, the scientific challenges for humans to get to some level of normalcy, I think, is still beyond us. But we have it within our capacity to get there. But then the question maybe you're asking is beyond that. If you go out a few centuries, is it possible that humans will be a multi-planetary species? I think the answer is yes. Part of it is, why not? We've always been explorers. The history of humanity is we jumped into canoes and we wanted to know what was over the horizon, what was out there. And we settled a lot of the Earth that way, taking big risks. So I think it's part of what it means to be human, to be an explorer. Space seems like a logical next place for us to head out to, the remarkable expanse and scale of what's out there. We do have some challenges with that, though, as you probably have thought about it yourself. The distances are phenomenal, right? So we do probably need to either figure out how to move very fast through space or figure out if there's some little tricks for skipping through space, large distances, which we think we might find or discover in the next few decades. And the second point, of course, is if you assume that, which we should scientifically, that the Earth will have a lifespan and so will the sun. The sun burns out, therefore the Earth can't exist. If we want any longevity to humanity, we have to leave the Earth. It's an absolute necessity. I love that you challenged me to think big so quickly. It's all theoretical right now. Aspirationally, I think, though, it seems inevitable and logical that we would be a multiplanetary species in the very long term.
Sorry to expand already the conversation, because the next question is, although we now talked about space, I would like to understand what you mean under the term city.
We're back to Earth.
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'm happy, though. I loved going out to space so quickly. So we're headed back to Earth now. I wrote, you know, several books on cities. I wrote the bestseller Smart Cities for Dummies. It's not for dummies. It's for everybody, whether you're a beginner or an expert. And in it, I talk about this very topic. What exactly is a city? And I would have thought going into the research for the book, this would be a simple thing to answer, right? A city is, you know, and here's the definition. Anybody who works in the space, including yourself, discovered that there isn't a universally accepted definition, right? And so here's what I've assembled based on the research across different organizations and dictionaries. It's obviously a place where there's a density of humans living. They live in close proximity. All the core services available, from water to sanitary to education to health to economics. There's governance. There's a unifying governance process. Some people will say there is a sort of a headcount per square mile definition. And I wish I had that at my fingertips. I don't. Maybe we'll put it in the podcast notes. I think that's the other characteristic. It's a place with a population that's more than just a village or a town. It's certainly a few thousand people, maybe 10,000 people or more. But beyond that, there isn't a lot more that defines it. It's the fact that there's every service that's required. There's a density of people and infrastructure, and there's governance managing it under one umbrella.
Then the question is, what does urban living mean to you? You just mentioned that towns and villages are different from a city based on headcount. How does the urban living differ for you from the rural living, from the town living, from the village living?
Yeah, it's definitely a little gray. There's a ton of overlap. Size, both physical size, geographic size, and population size is a determinant, plus the availability of services. In your typical village, you're not going to get every single service that you would find in a city, where cities have an abundance of services and a variety and competition of services, products and services. Goodness, how would I describe urban living beyond that? One of the ways, here's the way I might think about it. You know, I was born in a city. I was born in Europe, in Dublin, Ireland. And I didn't really think about it too much, but I'm a city person. I'm a city slicker. I like living in the city. Because of a job opportunity, I was asked to work in a place that was north of San Francisco. And very quickly, as you go north of San Francisco into Sonoma County and the wine region, which is really beautiful, you're into countryside, into the rural areas almost immediately once you go over the Golden Gate, which is just north of the city. And I was asked to work for this company. I was successful in getting the opportunity and I was looking forward to it. And it meant that I would have to live in a place that was more rural than I had ever lived in. It wasn't exactly, you know, farmland for hundreds of miles, but it was certainly not a big city area. And I quickly recognized what I was missing. There was a type of lifestyle, a convenience of lifestyle, proximity of other people and services that were not available that I had been used to living in an urban environment my entire life. The distances to go to a shopping center or a mall or something were longer. As a plus, it was quieter and probably the air was a lot healthier. And it was nice to go for strolls in the morning along little streams and things. But it was so different for me that I actually felt compelled to move back to a more traditional urban environment. So in my own experience, I found the rural to be quite different than what I was used to. And I knew that I wanted to be in an urban environment for the reasons I described. One really ridiculous reason, but logical in my world, was proximity to a major airport. So when I need to travel internationally, which I do a lot, when I was living in this area, the San Francisco International Airport was about an hour and a half drive to get to it. No time in my life had I ever been that far away from an international airport, never more than probably 30 minutes. And that felt weird to me. You know, when I came back from that international location, came back on a long flight, get back, get my baggage, maybe get my car or perhaps get an Uber, a taxi. It was going to be another hour and a half before I got home. Like the equivalent of a short flight, if you like. Where I live right now, I'm only 20 minutes from the airport and I love it because I travel a lot. So that, I think we would consider an urban environment as having some type of airport relatively close that can get you to most places or get you to another hub that gets you to an international location pretty fast. Maybe later on when I'm out for a walk or something, I'll think of a better answer. But those are the thoughts that come to me right now.
Thank you for sharing your own example, because sometimes we can imagine that living in the rural area with the current technology would be the same, because we can order everything. Everything can be delivered to us. There is no real problem with the rural areas, not even problems, but differences. And it's really interesting that you described your own experience on how it differed for you. Let's get back to this smart city idea. What does the smart city mean to you?
I spent the last almost 13 years trying to come up with a great definition and explain this to people who ask often. And I've come to the conclusion, in fact, that while a definition is hard to come by and an agreed one, it's less about the definition and much more about the outcomes. What do we want a city to be? What do we think are the minimum requirements for a high-performance city? When we use the word smart city, it's a bit of a marketing term. But look, I'll honor the question. And I've written a book called Smart Cities for Dummies, so I probably should have some notion of that terminology. I say it in the book, whether you like the term or not, it's stuck, right? It's the one we're kind of just dealing with. I like to think of it, by the way, as smarter and more sustainable cities. I like to add smart and sustainability into the description because I don't think these are separable anymore. There's huge overlap. The word smart's used in lots of contexts today, right? Smart homes, smart airports, smart stadiums. We certainly have used it a lot. And we're using it to refer to a lot of technology. We're using it to refer to connectivity, the Internet of Things, connecting things. We refer to smart when we're talking about the productive use of data to make better decisions, to drive evidence-based decision-making. We use the word smart when we're talking about reinventing and innovating old ways of doing things so they can be delivered in completely new ways and with technology as the basis. For example, the use of or experimentation with self-driving vehicles or with drones. But I also think it goes beyond that. I think of smart cities are as ones that engage their communities, that are very engaging, that there's a richer democracy at work. People can be part of decision-making. People can even develop solutions. They can co-create with City Hall. I think that's very important. There are some big themes. Now, I've had the opportunity to work in cities all over the world, work with city leaders. And there's a top tier of themes that you see over and over again when we think about cities that are trying to be better at what they do, to rethink what they're doing. In no particular order, digitalization, right? This is the movement from anything analog, all that paperwork, all that old way of doing things, to accessing services on a smartphone, accessing services on a website, some basic sort of digital online activities. That's a multi-trillion dollar opportunity. Every city is in some form of transitioning from the old analog paper-based world to more of a digital-centric world. So that's a big one. Number two is transportation, right? It doesn't really matter what you do, what your role is in a city, whether you're a visitor, tourist, a worker, child, older person, whatever it is, you're experiencing transportation probably every single day. And it could be that you walk, it could be that you drive, it could be that you get a bus, you cycle, right? Whatever it is that you do, transportation is something we experience a lot. And I think we'd all agree in many cities in the world, it's not optimum. There's traffic jams, right? And sometimes cycling in traffic is dangerous. Buses don't come often enough. There aren't enough buses. There's not enough public transportation. So now we look at a world where we have things like self-driving vehicles that are emerging, more light rail, a much greater emphasis on cycling and e-bikes, converting a lot of roads or accommodating bicycles now on roads all over cities. great projects like in Paris to convert and support bicycle paths on almost every major street. These are big projects. So transportation is a big one. Number three is energy and the energy transition. Again, there's no such thing as a functioning city without some source of energy to power everything, right? Whether it's your sanitary system or just the electricity in your home or Wi-Fi, whatever it is that you need. We need a lot of power, and our appetite for energy is not going away. If anything, we have more things that need power. Fortunately, we have alternatives now to the polluting carbon energy we've been using for the last couple of hundred years, oil, gas, and coal. Look, it's been cheap and abundant, and it's powered the modern economy of the world. But we had a great party in the 20th century, and now we have a great big hangover in the 21st century. So now we have to figure out, how do we move to a world where we can use a clean, carbon-free, abundant energy? And we get that from the sun through solar. We can get through the wind with turbines and wind energy, geothermal from underneath the ground, and even nuclear is an option that provides a significant scale of clean energy. So there's the energy component here. So that's three big ones. There's a related, while I think of the fourth here, I will throw in something like cybersecurity into the mix. Because so much of our modern world, and particularly the urban environments, are connected, and there's a lot of data in transit, there's a lot of data being stored, and cities have a responsibility for enormous scale of data, there's a greater emphasis now on managing secure infrastructures in communities. And we need to make that a serious priority. Fifth, which is sustainability. So our cities, the biggest cities in the world, the megacities, those are the cities over 10 million people. It's a growing number. There's at least 25, 26 of those, and we're headed to about 35 over the next few years. These are big, complicated machines, right? And they're generating a lot of energy and a lot of waste. And a lot of it has been at a level, certainly we know it's unsustainable, we know that, but it's also been destructive, right? Destructive for the air, for the climate. We think, if you believe the scientific consensus, that we're in the early years of a climate emergency. And, you know, the water is not as clean as we would like it. The streams and the oceans are not as clean as a follow-on result. People don't have green spaces to go to. There's mental health issues as a consequence. So all of these are areas in which cities are the context for them. And if the cities are causing these, we have to fix them inside the cities. And so that's the fourth big trend, or fifth, if you consider cybersecurity within the list there. So if a city is prioritizing at least those five and has a progressive, documented approach, I would consider them to be doing some pretty smart and sustainable things. Now, the assumption is they're making progress. They're actually moving forward. They're moving the needle. They have the investment that's needed. They're making the investment that's needed, and they have participation. Then I think that's probably a good set of criteria for what we mean by a smart city.
It was amazing you said that smart and sustainable need to be connected in cities. Apo Huovila is one of the first researchers say so, and he was on the podcast talking about this idea around December. You have started to talk about some of the issues. What are your three biggest concerns or fears regarding the future of cities?
It's a long list, as you can imagine. Let me start by saying cities do a lot of things right. Okay, I'm actually very bullish on cities. I'm an advocate, but I'm not naive. I think there's things that cities do well, and I'm very conscious, as we many of us are, of what our cities do poorly or are poorly prepared for. There's never been anything in human history that's brought more people out of extreme poverty than cities. The data is really clear on this. Between the years 2008 and 2015, in India, up to 200 million people were brought out of extreme poverty into the working classes and beyond because of cities, because of urbanization. That's a remarkable achievement and has happened in an accelerated way all throughout Southeast Asia. It's happening now in Africa and in many underdeveloped areas of the world. Now, I understand listening to this, there are points in there that can be debated. So I want to accept that. And I'm open-minded to acknowledging that our uncontrollable growth, our uncontrollable progress that we've seen through the 20th century now to the 21st has had a lot of poor consequences. Not everybody thrived. We have very notable issues with inclusion and inequality. We still have significant poverty issues. I'm quite sober on this topic in that regard. But I do look also at the extent of the positives, the greater access to healthcare, greater access to education, more discretionary income for larger amounts of people, more free time, more rights through unions, and everything that goes with the industrialized world, which often equals the urban world. So what do I think? So then looking at the big challenges of cities and what I'm worried about, you said the top three, I think it was. I worry about politics. Probably that's a surprising answer. Maybe you're looking for a technological answer. We have more ways to communicate than ever before. And yet we're often using our instruments of communication for negative things, for cyberbullying or promoting conspiracy theories or fake information. So these things are a little bit worrisome. And they're not limited, of course, to urban areas. This is a global phenomena. But if 60% of humanity lives in cities, and by 2050, it's like closer to 70%, like almost everybody impacted by problems with our politics that are accentuated by issues with our communication tools and the attendant phenomena that goes with it, which is way beyond the scope of this call. From a technological perspective, I do think energy is at the heart of a lot of our challenges. If you have abundant clean energy, that's a real game changer. Think about if we were to burn more oil, extract more oil, burn more gas, burn more coal, extract more coal, extract more gas, kept doing it. We did it faster and bigger and in more places in the earth. Consequences of that are dire, right? Not just in terms of the environment, but also for the atmosphere and the climate. So that's not a good direction. And we were headed in an upward direction in terms of consumption of those carbon energy for much of the 20th century and up until recently. So if we can transition in an orderly manner to a world that is primarily clean energy, it makes a big deal. It makes a big difference. It could, at some level, reduce the cost of energy, which would be nice and allow more people to have access to more of the things that you and I have access to every day. They're not the same things as what everybody has access to. But the environment would be cleaner. The air would be cleaner. There'll be less carbon in the atmosphere, hopefully stabilizing some of the average temperature rise we see or project over the next few decades. And with abundant clean energy, we can innovate without the guilt and do sort of innovation that helps humanity at a great scale. I might say that the third one broad would be economics. It's just making it all work. Today we have an unworkable economic situation. We have stagnant wages around the world, but increasing prices, and that's not sustainable. There was a time when a person in the United States could get a middle-class job and buy a house. That's beginning to be very difficult, and sometimes in some places impossible. I'm not going to talk about other places in the world because there are other dynamics at play, and I'm not an expert at other places. All I can tell you is in most of the places I visit, there is a housing crisis. There's not enough homes for the number of people, and the cost of homes are very expensive as a consequence. So I think our kind of economic model, if not tweaked, you know, such that prices get more in line with salaries and salaries see some outward pressure, if we don't see some readjustment there in a way that makes sense for more people, this problem could be even more difficult in the future. People won't stand for it in the long term. What happens when people, when you push people into a corner, push, eventually things break and people reject it. And that's very bad for any society. So when I talk about economic, I want it to be clear that it relates to things like homelessness, for example, or poverty, right? And things like inclusion, the have and the have nots, too much wealth and too few hands, and crime, violence, and everything that goes with that. And again, why do I bring this up? Because this could be spoken about in any type of conversation. Because it's happening mostly in cities, the platform for this. One of the things innovation does is it does produce more quantity at lower cost, which democratizes access to things. We've seen that through the 21st century. Those have been positives. Abundance of products, lots of choice, low-cost computers, low-cost conveniences. There's some complexity here that I think we're going to have some novel approaches over the next few decades because, again, where we are today is not sustainable.
Just a note regarding energy and abundant clean energy. Vilma Kaskir talks about the climate change and using all of the fossil fuels as an existential risk in his book titled What We Owe the Future, because if we use up every amount of fossil fuels which is easily available, then if we have a huge collapse in society, then the next society will have a harder time to access easy energy and build up their energy until they can get transformed to the abundant clean energy. It's not just talking about and thinking about climate change, but it's also in longer term thinking about as a resilience strategy that maybe we shouldn't just use everything up for ourselves. So the fears were uncontrollable progress and growth with inclusion and equality and economics and the energy all involved in cities, and also the politics with the negative communication strategies we currently have. And you also started to talk about, in my understanding, the opportunities and the strengths. What are the three biggest opportunities for you regarding the future of cities?
I only pause when you ask these questions because I have to pick from a long list. That's what I'm really doing. It's not that I can't think of any. It's like, what is most valuable? Here's how I might think of this question. There's low-hanging fruit, as we say in the US. There's things that are easier that are opportunities, and there are things that are harder that are opportunities. In terms of easier things, cities have an abundance of data. And, you know, I've written recently a book called Data Governance for Dummies, as it happens, still part of that series, where I had to research this topic for about a year before I wrote my book. I realized that data is the most valuable asset in every organization today. Data is becoming the 21st century engine of economic growth, like oil was in the 20th century and coal was in the 19th century and before. Data seems to be the engine for that. And it's also a place where cities can make better decisions, where they can have better products, where they can co-create and innovate with their communities. When I look out at the cities I work with, and when I do a review of cities around the world, every one of them collects, creates, stores, uses data. They don't all do it very well, and they're missing an opportunity. And it doesn't take a massive leap of investment and change to be able to make the changes that are really positive. So I look at that as that one of those three really easy opportunities to go for. The second is probably cloud computing. So I worked in a city as a chief technology officer and chief innovation officer for almost a decade. And, you know, I can conclude during that time and now looking back that cloud computing is a blessing to cities. The idea that cities can build a data center and manage a data center like a private company is a myth. Now, for a long time, cities didn't embrace cloud services, technology services accessed over online from third-party providers, because they were worried about security, worried about losing control. But those issues have largely been resolved. And so now, if a city needs any number of services, they should be able to slap down a credit card or subscribe to a service that provides it to them. Everything from permitting software to new financial systems to systems that run the traffic signals. All of this now can be provided with ease over the cloud, rather than having a large internal IT staff with a data center that's not kept up to date, is insecure, doesn't have adequate investing. So I think cloud computing is an incredibly important opportunity. And maybe the third, in terms of easy opportunities, is embracing mobile. In my strategy in the city that I worked in, we had a cloud first, mobile first strategy. We had this already over a decade ago when nobody else in cities was really thinking about it. I thought it was a bit, maybe a little crazy, maybe a bit risky, but turned out that private sector wholeheartedly embraced this, saw the benefits, and now cities are. Go to where the people are rather than requiring the people to come to you. And, you know, most major cities now have a number of apps, mobile apps that allow people to do things quickly, whether it's pay a parking ticket or access documentation or make a request, all the typical things you do with a city. Now, the opportunities more longer term. Let's see. This is a funny one, but I have to throw it in because I think it's impactful and easier to access, is to begin your strategy to support cycling and to support bicycles. There's a good news story on this. Like, cities are beginning to do this, to see places like Paris transformed, where 10 years ago, barely anybody cycled. And today, Paris is a big cycling city. And increasingly, communities all through Asia, through Europe, and even into the Middle East are rolling out cycling paths and cycling tunnels and having more bicycles available to rent, conveniently placed. I think there's just a big opportunity there. There's a great dividend to investing in cycling infrastructure, you know, in terms of health, right? But also lower carbon emissions, lower cost for people, more fun, quieter, right? I was watching a video on YouTube the other day of an intersection. I think it was in Vietnam. They show before with cars and then they show afterwards with bicycles. And the noise difference is notable, never mind the emissions and the stress and everything that goes with that. I think there's a greater opportunity for more community engagement. I think that there's still a mindset in some city halls around the world that people pay taxes, people expect the mayor and the city manager and the team to do the work, deliver the services, and everybody is happy. The truth is, that hasn't been the case for since who knows, right? For decades and decades. You pay a dollar in taxes, you're not necessarily getting a dollar back in services, right? The only way we're going to ever catch up and maybe even get ahead of what the needs are is by significant collaboration and co-creation. For example, where in the city I worked, there were lots of times when we were requested to build something like a system that would allow people to know what construction was happening in the community. But look, yeah, we could have done it, but there were 100 other projects in front of it that were probably more important. So how could we solve that problem? We said, we got the data. We have all the data, permitting data in the permitting system. Let's open that up. And if an innovator in the community wants to build an interface on top of it, or a group of software developers want to build a business, let's help them do that. And they build the software. They can even build a business, hire people, which has an economic side to it. And then they're motivated to move fast and to get the solution into people's hands. So you solve it that way. But also collaborating, co-creation means that community members are more informed. They have more data to be able to be more engaged in the conversation and the difficult choices, the difficult budgeting choices, for example. And, you know, I often get asked by the cities, like, how can we get more people involved? And then sometimes people in the community say, how can we be more involved? And for the former, I say, invite people. Invite people. When people are invited to participate, they will often respond. And for the community, I say, volunteer yourself. Make yourself available. Go into the city hall and say, how can I help? Can I meet with the city manager? Can I become part of a committee or a volunteer group, or are there part-time jobs? How can I make a difference? Yeah, you know, sometimes just making that call or walking into city hall can make all the difference, because frankly, we all need a lot of help. So I know it's a long answer, but I think those are the kinds of things we need to be thinking about when we think about the opportunities.
What are you excited about and what surprises you in the current urban transformation and urban futures?
Well, getting back to the topic of technology specifically, I think self-driving vehicles or autonomous vehicles are compelling. So let me tell you why. Let me defend that statement. Here, I'm talking about cars that drive themselves, okay? Trucks, buses that drive themselves. Now, I know it's going to displace workers. Maybe that's a topic for another time or later on. But let's just focus on other positive outcomes. Many people think, okay, when we have autonomous cars, it means I can get into my car and it's going to drive itself. And it ends there. Not even close. That's where it all begins. We have to recognize that through the 20th century and into the 21st century, we have built cities for cars. We didn't build it for people walking around. We built it for cars moving people around, people driving cars. So we built the grid system. We deployed traffic lights, stop signs, signage. We built parking spaces and parking lots, multi-story parking lots and parking lots around supermarkets and malls. We built massive infrastructure and paved over paradise to enable the car. In some urban environments, 60% of the land use is for cars. So we did this for cars that humans drive. If cars drive themselves, almost every single thing I've just listed there can be thought of differently. For example, you don't have to have traffic lights with self-driving cars. You don't have to have stop signs. You don't even need lanes, right? Because computers driving cars don't need the things that humans need. The cars will talk to each other. The cars will detect and avoid things, right? You don't need the grid system. What am I basically saying? I'm saying that when cars go autonomous, we can completely rethink how we design and build cities. And we will. We don't need parking spaces, right? Self-driving cars don't need to park, right? We don't need multi-story parking lot. We don't need massive acres and acres of huge parking lots around malls in suburban America or in cities around the world. What a horrible use of land and a waste of land and expensive use of land, right? So I think we're going to be able to redesign cities. This is a very big deal. Okay, what else? We know that cars have been incredible, right? I acknowledge I like cars, but we also know we're not very good at driving them. And we kill each other at a rate of 1.4 million people per year. 1.4 million people die in car accidents every year. That's somebody's mother, somebody's father, somebody's child, friend, brother or sister. It's a horror story multiplied by several million. With computers driving cars, we may not get it to zero. Fair enough. Even autonomous vehicles are going to crash. they are. And they're going to hurt people and they're going to cause damage. But we don't think it's going to be 1.4 million deaths per year. Would we be happy if it was even half that, right? If we halved it or made it a quarter, that would be some accomplishment, right? And then the last thing I might say about autonomous is they're going to be electric, right? And so the emissions will be much less. And it's possible, although there's some debate on this still, that the number of vehicles may be less. I'm open to be convinced otherwise, and I know this will be a debate for some time, but less vehicles on the road, we can move faster. There's less congestion, which combined with the mental anxiety that people go through sitting in traffic here in California, for example, reducing that would be a wonderful thing. So I'm really quite optimistic and excited by the potential of autonomous vehicles. I'll just add one more, but I'll be much more brief on this one, which is drone delivery, right? And drones, autonomous drones in general, I do think that we are going to see, once the regulations and the technology catches up sufficiently, and we think we're almost there, but we're going to see a lot of drones in the sky. I just hope they're going to be quiet because people won't tolerate the noise. My friends who work in the drone industry say, yes, they're going to be much quieter than they appear today, certainly quieter than the hobby drones that a lot of people play with. But the ability to deliver rapidly, the ability to move maybe medical products around a community, deliver medicine or blood from an accident or to an accident, I should say. The ability to use drones for inspections and for maybe even rescue and for extinguishing fires by having water hoses connected to drones, large-scale drones, which will come too. And so I think there's a lot of promise there, and we'll see passenger drones too. We'll definitely see flying passenger drones in the sky. The affordability of those and the scale of that is still unknown. But those are two things which I think I'm pretty pumped up about.
And then what is your role in establishing the future of cities, beside being excited about these opportunities?
I think my role, which is already something that's reasonably well understood, is primarily as an educator. That's where I enter the topic these days. I'm a professor. I'm an author. I write books. I write online videos, which are popular. I write articles. And beyond that, I do workshops and I advise cities. So as an educator, I think I can be quite useful in helping city leaders and vendors and all sorts of government members understand what's possible, understand the opportunities and risks, help develop plans and strategies. These are all things I do today. I think I play a role in that. Cities don't necessarily want to be the first. They do want to know best practices and they want to understand like the pitfalls before they enter into something a little bit more risky. So I think I can help with that, and I do help with that. And then there's the practical side. I've never been and will never be just an academic, somebody who just talks. I also develop strategies, and these strategies then get implemented. I recently wrote a strategy working with a community here in Northern California for their technological work for the next 5 years to prepare for and address both the problems they have and some opportunities. So there's that. And then I think probably just in the short time we have, I think the final piece would be that I want to help and inspire others to be agents of change. And so that means what we call GovTech or urban tech businesses that want to develop products. They want to do important work and they also want to do well. And I'm a coach and a mentor for them, and I can help them understand how to sell into government and how to build for government. And then I think through my teaching and my keynotes that I do at the events all around the world, perhaps there's one person in the audience who is trying to figure out what they want to do with their future, and something I say or show them inspires them to take their life in a different direction and do really important work that makes a difference and gives them meaning and changes the world in a positive way. So I think those are my roles right now and probably for a long time to come.
Jonathan, thank you so much for your work, because we met at a conference. You gave a keynote speech and a few other speeches, which were really amazing. And I experienced firsthand how you are sharing your knowledge and educating the audience. So thank you so much for that. And before we jump into the last question, why do you write books for kids?
I wrote a book called Smart Cities for Dummies a few years ago. And it's a book for grown-ups. It's a serious book, about 300 pages of the whole story of the history of cities, the present and the future of cities. And it's done very well. When I first wrote it, I sent it out to some of my friends and family. And I said, you know, a few weeks later, I said, what do you think? Was it okay? And more than one said they hadn't read it. I said, "What? Why? What's going on?" They said, "Our kids are reading it. My child is reading it." And I said, "Really? I did not expect kids to read Smart Cities for Dummies." And I said, "Why are they reading?" They said, "There's a lot of great stories in there, Jonathan. There's stories about what it was like when there was horses in Manhattan, or the aqueducts that the Romans built all over Europe, and how they were able to actually move water uphill as opposed to just downhill. There's great stories in there, the original urban innovation." I said, "That's something I never thought about." Turns out kids of all ages and teenagers and young people are interested in their communities and interested in their cities. They're interested in a better future. They really are, more than we ever give them credit for. My quick story, by the way, on this is over 10 years ago, I was getting ready to manage and host the largest hackathon, outdoor hackathon in the world. It's called City Camp Palo Alto. And I went to visit the schools and I said to the teachers, "How can we get the kids involved?" And they said, "Actually, the children have their own little governance committees. They do like activity committees." And so I said, "Can I speak to them?" And they said, "Sure." I went to talk. I said, "Hey, I'm having this big outdoor hackathon. How can you get involved? How can we have you participate?" And they were like all over it. And later on, I found out, I said, "Why were you so excited about it? What was it that kind of got you really pumped up?" And they said, "We had never been asked before. No one in the city had ever come to us and asked us to be involved in the city. In the 100 years or so of the city I was working for, no one had ever gone to the kids and said, 'We want you involved.'" So I was humbled by that, but also it was a light bulb moment. Kids want to be involved. They want to be educated on this. After I found out that many kids were reading my Smart Cities for Dummies, I thought maybe this would be a good topic for kids. Now, coincidentally, a children's book author from another city in California reached out to me and asked me actually to write a book with him about cities for kids. So we did. We collaborated and we wrote the first one called Exploring Smart Cities Activity Book for Kids, which is available online. It's got tons of like puzzles and educational things, connected dots and coloring and lots of cool stuff. Parents, teachers, and kids love it. And then later on, we wrote a second book called Exploring Cities Bedtime Rhymes, so that kids could have a little laugh reading rhymes about cities, but also learning at the same time. And then recently, I was approached by a colleague of mine who lives in Dubai of Indian descent. And he asked, "Is it possible that we could translate it to Hindi?" And so I said, "Wow, what an incredible opportunity to reach the children of India, hundreds of millions there, but also the Indian diaspora of families around the world who would like to maintain Hindi in their households and be able to share those experiences and those reading times with their kids." And so we just wrote that. It's exactly the same book, Exploring Cities, Bedtime Rhymes, but it's entirely in Hindi. It's only been out a couple of weeks. It's right now, it's September 2023. So who knows by the time this goes live, what it'll be like. But I do it because it gives me great joy to be able to educate and share the topic of the future of our planet with children who will be the leaders of their cities and the planet in the future.
And you have been very generous with your time today as well. Do you have any closing comments or requests for the audience?
Thank you. I hope we covered a lot. I spoke a lot here today with you and I shared a lot of the challenges and opportunities. Cities are not something that you can sit back and say you are not part of, because if you're part of the growing percentage of the world who live in cities, you're part of cities. And solutions mean increasingly that we all have to be participating. So I think my message is there's no shortage of ways that you can be an agent of change and build a better city that you live in. You can volunteer at your city hall. You can run for an election to be part of your council or a committee. You could write software. There's so many different problems to solve. You can be an advisor to your city. You can have a neighborhood group. So look, there's just so many different ways you can be part of building better communities anywhere in the world. You cannot say you don't know how to help. You can't say there's no way I can help. It's quite the opposite. It really matters. And you know what really matters is that you vote. If you have the privilege of being able to vote where you live, where you're listening to this, look, you got to get out and vote. In many communities, people don't vote. Voting means registering, means going on polling day to vote. But voting also means how you spend your money. Every time you elect to buy something, you're voting on whether you think that product is sustainable, you think that company is ethical. So you have more power than you think. You have a lot more power than you think. And so I would say get engaged, exert that power, and help us all together. We can build, I think, better cities for the 21st century.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Fanny. This was fun.
It was really
interesting to hear from Jonathan his balanced view on cities being great wealth generation drivers, but not without challenges. Not to mention his requirement for smart cities to be also sustainable. Apo Huovila talks about this notion in episode 174. You can find out more about Jonathan online. All the links are in the show notes. What was the most interesting part for you? What questions did arise regarding Jonathan's approach to the future of cities? What have you learned from this interview? Let me know on Twitter at WTF4Cities or on the WTF4Cities.com website where the transcripts and show notes are available. You can also subscribe on the website not to miss any new episodes and leave some feedback. I hope this was an interesting interview for you as well, and thanks for tuning in.
What is the Future for Cities podcast?